On Thursday night, an Atlantic weather front will spread some rain east across the UK. Some heavy bursts, and still on Friday morning for southeast England, it could be heavy for a time. But as that clears, the rest of Friday looks like being another dry and bright day. That's the forecast. Back to Vaughan Savage.
Many thanks, Nick. And don't forget that if you're looking out for the shipping forecast, it will be here in about 15 minutes' time. Now to our book of the week. Philip Hoare's Celebration of the Sea, The Sea Life, has taken us to Southampton Water and even to London. This time there's an exotic leap in location in another reading from The Sea Inside.
Drew and I squeeze into the tuk-tuk, knees drawn up on the plastic-covered seat. A gilt Buddha swings from the rear-view mirror. The muezzin's call from across the street has already begun. At 4 in the morning, people are walking to work in the middle of the road, leaving the pavement to the animals. Bikes loom out of the dark with huge boxes of fish balanced over their back wheels. Our headlight reflects the retinas of dogs, stretching themselves after a night curled up in the dust. The tuk-tuk jerks to a halt at a gap in the trees, out of which a man appears, gathering up his green and orange sarong against the rubbish that lines the footpath. Handsome, with high cheekbones, Rasika wears a peaked camouflage cap that lends him the air of a freedom fighter. We follow him. At the end of the path is a starlit sea. Rasika steadies the Kushan Puta for us to board. The boat barely measures 20 feet, its fiberglass patched here and there with uncertain stains on its once white surface. We balance on the makeshift blue-painted planks that straddle the boat. Rasika pushes off from the beach. As we leave Marissa behind and move out into the bay, my eyes get used to the darkness. I see fishing boats all around, returning from their night's work, nets bulging with silvery fish. Others are racing ahead, black shapes against the even blacker water. They somehow make the dark companionable. It's only 5:30, so I push my roll bag into the space under the prow, climb into the cubbyhole, tug my hood over my head, and curl up on the lumpy floor. Rasika has slowed the engine to a purr. Woken by the lack of motion, I slide myself out of my hole into the light, eyes blinking. Ahead, the surface has been broken by black shapes, the sharp fins and lithe leaping bodies of spinner dolphin. I clamber to my feet. "Come on, my boys," I shout, as they swerve and swoop. Rasika starts up his engine and they're off, racing in front of our bow as their kind do the world over, as if every dolphin were performing in a perpetual oceanic Olympics. With every break of the surface, their beaks poke up, prominent as broom handles, armed with dozens of sharp teeth. Suddenly, a group of common terns drop out of the sky, all angles as they dive into the same bait, whistling as if with the joy of having found such a fertile source of food. There's a series of sharper splashes, the frenetic, jagged leap of yellowfin tuna, launching themselves out of the water in their ferocious pursuit. Spiky slivers of silver with big round eyes. They look like something out of a cartoon. The ocean is alive. Rasika points ahead, almost whispering the word we've been waiting to hear. I can't see anything. Then, there. Yes. Something white against the blue. And again, it must be as tall as a house. And again, a vertical plume in a horizontal world. a geyser erupting out of the ocean. Kushanputar's engine picks up speed. I lean forward, white knuckles to the grab rail in front of me, head down. Suddenly, right off our bow, the whale surfaces, sending its calling card into the air. The steamy blow is 2 stories high. Balanoptera musculus, the blue whale. Something so beautiful as to be unbelievable. It's a gradual revelation. First, a dark lump, the splash guard to the whale's blowholes. Then, rolling behind its wedge-shaped head, its body. A living construction that leaves words in its wake. I've only seen this creature modelled in a museum. The reality is so far removed, so enormous, that the only thing I can fix on is the colour. It really is blue. At least in certain lights. A deep, petrolly blue, or the blue of a swallow's back. All around the world, people are going about their business. We are watching a blue whale about to dive. Subtly, the whale changes momentum, goes up a gear. You feel the animal flex and ripple, drawing up and pulling down. Suddenly, its flukes are held sharp against the sky, utterly enormous, at precise right angles to the animal. They hang there for a second, wobbling with their magnitude and the power of the body to which they are connected. They announce the end of the encounter. With this final flourish, our audience is over, leaving us wanting more. At Wuligama, a tiny island lies a few hundred feet offshore, little more than a palm-top rock. To reach it, there's no need to take a boat. The water that separates it from the land is seldom more than a few feet deep. Clustered on its summit is an eccentrically shaped villa, barely visible through the trees. Invited there one evening, we waded through the warm water, flaming torches spiked in the sand to guide us across. Reaching the white-painted jetty on the far side, we passed up a ferny path and into the house. Off an octagonal hall lay 8 doors. Around the whole building ran a wide veranda. The house was built in 1927 by the self-styled Count de Morny Talvond. Lured to Ceylon by the sight of a flame lily growing in a Bournemouth garden, de Morny looked for the one spot which, by its sublime beauty, would fulfil my dreams and hold me there for life. In 1925, at Wuligama, he found it. A red granite rock, covered with palms and jungle shrub, rising from the Indian Ocean, an emerald in a setting of pink coral. Having bought the island for 250 rupees, de Morny named it after the Greek name for Ceylon, Taprobany, meaning Garden of Delights. The house de Morny built on this 2.5-acre site was extraordinary, even for this extraordinary place. Hanging gardens tipped over its terraces, surrounding the octagonal villa. At the heart of this exquisite palace lay its Hall of the Lotus, open to the skies and lined with panels of blue and gold. It was entered through a theatrical arch dressed with blue silk curtains in the Art Nouveau style. Its dome rested on 8 sky-blue pillars. The entire house resembled a magical lantern set down on the tiny island, illuminated by golden light pouring through amber-coloured glass blinds. Throughout the 30s, European nobility called on Taprobany, but de Morny had only a few years to enjoy his grand entertainments. He died of a heart attack in 1941. One afternoon in 1949, in his country home near Salisbury, David Herbert, second son of the Earl of Pembroke, was showing his family albums to his friend, the American writer Paul Bowles. Turning the pages, Bowles happened on a photograph of Tap Probany, taken when Herbert had visited Ceylon in the 1930s. Bowles was transfixed. He was an inveterate wanderer in exotic places. He was also the newly successful author of The Sheltering Sky, a nightmarish story set in Morocco where he and his wife Jane were at the centre of a group of Bohemian expatriates. He determined to go to Ceylon and sailed from Antwerp that December. When he finally saw Tap Probany, the black and white photograph he had glimpsed in an English stately home became reality, and it exceeded his expectations. An embodiment of the innumerable fantasies and daydreams that had flitted through my mind since childhood. 2 years later, Bowles bought the island for $500. He relished his retreat. The maid polished the furniture and filled bowls with orchids. The gardener fetched things from the market in the village on the mainland. Another man, a Hindu, came twice a day to empty the latrines, as there was no running water on the island. Life moved like clockwork. There were no complications. In the evening, Bowles and his lover, Mohammed Temsamani, would wade across the water in their bathing suits, their servants carrying their master's clothes in bundles on their heads. On the other side, they would dress and set off in the direction of the devil dancers, whose displays had come to obsess the writer. At night, Bowles lay in bed, listening to the waves crashing on the island's seaward cliffs, contrasting them with the softer sound they made on the sandy bay. It was the greatest luxury he could imagine. He was untroubled by the sharks that swam around the reef, or by the enormous turtle that haunted the rocks, rising to the surface occasionally like a floating boulder, its great domed back an indication of its age, so the gardener said. During the hours of darkness, flying foxes hung in the trees to be chased away at daybreak by flocks of crows. Sitting at one of the Count's desks, cigarette holder in his mouth, fingers poised over his typewriter, Bowles wrote his novel The Spider's House. His wife Jane was much less enamoured of the island. She took to drinking, hard, and particularly objected to the flying foxes. They seemed to be leathery demons to her, and couldn't wait to leave. With the arrival of the high seas of the monsoons and the high taxes levied on foreigners, Paul Bowles was also driven out. After only 2 years on Tap Probany, Bowles sold up and retreated to Tangier. In the darkness, I swam around the rocks, the light from the torches flaring on the lapping waves. Only when it was time to leave did we realize how far the tide had risen. Wading across the water, which was now above thigh height, I had to support an older lady, elegantly clad in a gold-embroidered sari, as she picked her way through the swirling cocoa-coloured sea, like a waterlogged bird of paradise. I wouldn't have been surprised, looking back over my shoulder, if the entire island had disappeared behind us, sinking into the Indian Ocean.
Anthony Calf was reading From the Sea Inside by Philip Hoare. The producer was Duncan Minchell. Tomorrow, it's the watery expanses of New Zealand at the same time here on BBC Radio 4. Where it's time now for Sailing By. sailing by. And so to the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at midnight 15 on Thursday the 8th of August. The general synopsis at 1800. High, Faroes 1022, moving away steadily northeastwards. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. West Viking, variable 4, mainly fair, good. East Viking, north at Sierra, south at Sierra. Northerly or northwesterly, 5 or 6, occasionally 7 in south at Sierra. Mainly fair, good. East 40s, northerly 4 or 5, becoming variable 4, mainly fair.